Welcome, 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 everybody. This is PCWB, a professor and a comedian walking to a bar, and I'm your co-host, Saper Vakil.
And I'm your other co-host, Michael Knight.
Man, Mike, it's happening, man. This has been months in the making. This is the first episode. Welcome, everybody. What are we doing here, Mike?
I mean, it's in the title, a professional comedian walking to a bar, or this lovely facility that we're at. And then we brought along another professor, and we brought along another comedian, and we are going to talk way too much about things we have no business talking about.
There it is. There it is. So at the core of this thing, to our listeners out there, welcome, welcome. This is the idea. This is what you're getting into right now. This is about good conversations, about serious big topics that it's in the news, it's in the streets, it's in the books, but we want to have a new conversation that's funny and thoughtful. And as a professor, I can say, unfortunately, that doesn't even always happen at the university, right? It should. That's what I got into this for. But oftentimes, conversations can be tense and awkward, especially in this political climate. And so we thought we can laugh and think and talk with people who are funny and smart and the best in the business. In today's episode, in every episode, I think we're going to pick a few themes, but we'll probably go off script. And today we're going to talk about critical race theory, diversity, equity, and inclusion, Chicago politics, Trump in 2024, the DNC that's happening in Chicago this summer, and everything else that kind of goes off of that. And so we have two guests who are perfect for the topic. It's actually my absolute personal honor to introduce the first guest. It is Professor David Stovall from the University of Illinois, Chicago. Dr. Stovall is a professor in Black Studies as well as Criminology, Law, and Justice. But beyond that, he's been a mentor to me. So when I was a grad student, I was introduced to Dr. Stovall early on when he would come out to Oakland. I was doing my graduate work at Berkeley, and he was a captivating, committed scholar that a lot of us coming up into academia were looking to as a model for how to do the work with authenticity, with honesty, and with a deep ethical commitment to issues. And he's never wavered from that. And he continues to be a mentor. It's an absolute honor. And he did me the big favor of coming on as a guest for our first episode. So I want to say thank you, Dr. Stovall, and just, you know, give you a chance to say a few words by way of introduction.
Yeah, man, look, appreciate you, family. Look, for having somebody like myself, I'm a little more used to being uninvited. So this is a good space to be in, man. And thank you all for just doing this work, man, because a lot of times we don't think about the necessity of doing it. But y'all made it really happen, like for real. So thank y'all for that.
Shout out to the team for that. Yeah,
that's dope.
And I'll let Mike introduce our
I'm comment. Just now figuring it out, Saper. For the months that we've been planning this, you really just don't want to get fired, so you want the comics to say all the stuff that you can't say in class.
That's what he brought us here for.
We are at Northwestern University. You guys know what's going on. You guys
edit that part out. In the University of USA. I'm Michael Knight, Chicago-based comedian. Everything that he said, that's what we're here for, to have these conversations, get down to the nitty-gritty. Because, I mean, we talk to the same people, and we usually, as comics and professors, talk about the same topics, but we approach it from a different lens, and it can go good or bad for either one of us. So why not throw us all in a room and see what happens when we do it that way? But my guest that I brought today, man, leaves little no introduction. Calvin Evans, he's been featured on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. He's one of the stars of the show, The Chi. He's also been in Chicago PD. His IMDb, I don't want to get into it out of jealousy, but he's also seen on any stage in Chicago, let alone the States, let alone the world. And if you wouldn't mind, man, giving out a couple of words, Calvin.
Oh, man, thank you. Just to clarify, I've never been on The Chi. I was on Southside.
Southside, I mean, you see what happened though, right?
Southside, but no, I just didn't want to say The Chi. I was like, people be like, I ain't never seen that motherfucker. I'm up here. No.
Power Book 7. Wait a minute.
but yeah, man, I'm happy to be here, man. I love having, comedy has gotten away from like the, like, very, it's not as intellectual as it used to be. Mm. And I feel like it's kind of gotten to like this, short form social media space.
Mm. Right.
And comics not really talking about nothing, you know? Yeah. And I feel like this is a great opportunity to have bring levity to very serious subjects, or, you know, just kind of like you said, approach from a different lens. So I'm excited to sit down and talk to these guys.
Before we get too far into it, who do you think is more liable if you go out there and say the wrong thing about Trump or Palestine or whatever? Who do you think is more liable to get canceled and or fired out of our two worlds?
Interesting.
You know, it all depends on the network in which you are in, right? Because it can come, I don't think it's like a one over the other, right? I think it's more like wherever you are, wherever networks or groupings that you're in, that's the place where that cancellation can happen. So I think it can happen very quickly in both spaces, depending on what you're saying, who you're saying it to, and then how that's interpreted.
It's also the politics of the specific place that you're at, right? Mm-hmm. So for instance, the president of this university versus the president of another university, they're going to have different kinds of ecosystems that's going to be evaluated by. Yep.
Does that influence how you teach, what you teach, how you talk about what you teach?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would be lying if I say that it didn't. It doesn't mean that I'm constantly censoring. But do I keep in mind what my company is, who's in attendance? Absolutely.
I also think it's a moment to be brave, right? And you know, universities are fraught places, right? They always got some drama, and then, you know, at some universities you got this thing tenure, right? So you go up after 5 years, they judge a file, and then they say you can have a job to retirement. And a lot of people are getting canceled out, right, in terms of losing their jobs, getting fired, or what have you. But I think this is the opportunity for the folks who do have that kind of minimal protection, I would argue, to go even harder, right? Mm. So that thing around, if there is that protection, at least there's the space where you can fight to make sure that what they say is what they're doing in terms of the university. But this is that moment, I think, to kind of elevate that, right? So if you got a platform, venue, a way by which to speak, I think it's important to be factual, but I also think it's that moment, like Calvin said, to rev up what we're engaging, right? So you can you can get into it, but now we want to get into it in those spaces that are factual, right? And not just conjecture, you know, making shit up, but saying, look, if we're going to do this, let us be clear, let us go into it and say, look, if we understand that what we're going to say is going to get a response, do not wait for the enemy to come. Expect them to come, right? It's not if they're coming, it's when, right? So now you say, all right, look, this is what it is. I know they about to come. You know, it's in Chicago, we say them people about to come,
right?
So that thing around being expectant of that and not paranoid by it. Because if you become paranoid to it, then you won't do it. Right, but it's the other ones to say, okay, if I'm going to say this, I know such and such got my back. I know when I go over here, I'm going to talk to such and such to make sure it's right. And then I'm going to continue to do that because I know they're going to perpetually be coming.
Doc, but this is actually what you're saying points out one of the key differences between, I feel like, comics and professors. There's a contradiction here, right? On the one hand, you mentioned tenure. So as you know, I have tenure, you have tenure. So we have these mechanisms in place in universities to protect us. That's what they're there for. Now, they don't work perfectly all the time. We know that. But it's an actual mechanism there, a structure to protect us to say, in theory, whatever it is we want to say, right? Comedians don't have that. Mm-hmm. And yet, you guys are more honest most of the time than
real talk. I don't have health insurance. Like, ain't nobody paying me. You're not paying my health insurance?
That's real
like, you
talk.
Can't. So you really can't tell me, I feel like as a comedian, how I feel and what I think is what I present, and my I'm not I don't have to be right in terms of that. Like how I feel, like I could tell a joke about one thing and then 2 years later be like, oh yeah, I don't even think like that no more, because I can grow on my thought, but the purpose of it is for me to be funny,
right?
Hey, so as long as people laugh and it's done in good taste, I'm fine. Mm.
So does that kind of free you? Do you feel like that frees you up more? Like the fact you're just like, look, man, like I'm doing this for me, by me, now, does that kind of free you up?
But that's what as a comedian, that's what you want to get to, because they say it's finding your voice. Because up until a certain period of time when you're doing comedy, you're just telling jokes, right? But then once you find your voice, where people, when you hear Kevin Hart voice, when you hear Dave Chappelle voice, when you hear Chris Rock voice, it's because they found their voice, and you know. When they get on stage, you know what angle they're coming at things. And once you accept that, then it's like, okay, fine. That's what. So, like, for instance, Louis C.K., you know, he had the situation he had, and people was like, oh, he canceled. And then a year or two went by, and then he's selling out clubs again. He's not doing it on a level that he was doing it, but people still want to hear his voice because, God damn it, he's a damn good comedian, independent of, you know, the things he did.
The transgressions.
Right, you know, in his personal life. So it's like, but I still want to hear. So it's like, you can't really cancel a person when you agree with their ideology. You see what I'm saying?
And I think we have your question coming up first. We're going to get into DEI. But one thing I wanted to say is, like, it feels like when it comes to, like, a college-bound kid that's going there, that's an investment on their future, right? When somebody's coming to a comedy show, that's a payoff.
Just entertain.
Like, I'm coming to be entertained, but either one of us can say the wrong... You're going to say the wrong thing, because any joke is going to be two sides. It doesn't hit home until it does hit home, and somebody's like, I didn't like what you said. The whole rest of the room could be laughing and having a good time, but that one person that your joke hit home for, that's usually going to be the loudest person in the room.
But that's it's an entertainment buffet, though.
Yeah.
Right? I'm not eating the Jell-O. Skip the Jell-O. What a cookie. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? But from y'all's standpoint, when it comes to, because you're shaping minds as professors, so if y'all say something that somebody doesn't agree with, they can challenge you. They can take it to it. They can take it to the next. To a higher up with me or us.
Yeah. What do you say when somebody challenges you when you're just, shut your face?
No, but I've had people come to me. Yeah, I did a joke about Joe Biden, and this lady came to me. She came to me after the show. I was on a cruise ship, and she was like, "Yeah, I don't think you should be talking about the president." And some lady behind her was like, "What the fuck you talking about? That's comedy. Get the fuck out the way."
Yeah.
And the lady just like, it just pushed the lady out the way. And my thing is, I never. Al Pacino said it in what movie was that?
Heat.
No. It was Al Pacino in the movie with Keanu Reeves.
Devil's Advocate.
Devil's Advocate. He said, freedom is never having to apologize. And I feel like I have that freedom on stage, but I also have a responsibility that my goal is not to offend anybody when I tell jokes. I want to come at it from a very intelligent, like top of the brain point of view. But if I do offend you, understand that offense is coming solely from you, because I didn't say anything to offend you. May not like the subject matter, you might not like that I made something funny, but I didn't purposely say like, oh, fuck this people, or fuck, you know, I didn't point anybody out. So I think people as comedians, people internalize what we say as you're making this thing true. It's like, no, this is just my opinion.
How do you feel about the handcuffs, like the golden handcuffs that they got, that they have to dance around certain subjects or stay away from certain topics or not speak their truth? They might have to stick to the curriculum. I'm speaking completely out of my ass. But when we're up there, like, it's, you can literally say the worst that's going to happen is you walk somebody or walk the room or whatever it is. But also that's not good for the overall brand necessarily. Like, how do you, not pandering, but you know what I'm saying? Like, you try and be balanced, or you try and be, come at it from a certain angle, or you stay away from certain things?
I don't stay away from anything. I feel like our responsibility is to speak to the world that we live in.
Right.
Right? If I get on stage, if somebody slips and fall up the stairs or coming down the stairs onto the stage, if I get on stage and I never acknowledge that, people going to be like,
that's the worst.
They're like, what? You have a responsibility.
Like, hey, you're not going to say nothing? Yeah. Like, hey, hey, just even if I did a show, this comic went up before me. She was drunk, went on way too long. And the host got back on stage, and she was just like, she just did some time, like, to try to, like, reset the room. And then when I got on stage, I said, hey, man, I want to give it up for y'all, because she was drunk as hell, and y'all didn't leave. The crowd laughed for like 3 minutes straight, very, like, hard.
Because,
like,
they know that you were present.
Because it was like, man, that happened. Thank you, because it was weird for us. You said it.
Yeah.
And now we can move on from it, because, you know what I'm saying?
But that is what I think props can learn from.
Yep.
Right? So now when you talk about, what is it that, if we're in the world, how do we learn from the world, right? And then if we're learning from the world, then how do we actually put that in classroom space? So one of the things that I think we have at our disposal is a precursor, right? And the precursor is, like, I start every class with, look, the material here, many of you will disagree with, right? And because you will, you always got a choice. First choice is there are other sections of this class. Second choice is, look, you have your, it is your right to respond in the way that you see fit. The only thing I ask is that we base our responses in some form of evidence, right? Mm-hmm. So this thing around, so I got this from a guy, OG scholar by the name of Rashid Khalidi, right? Mm-hmm. Palestinian brother, really is clear about what's happening in the current moment. But also he said this thing to me and I was like, damn, he was like, look, man, if you gonna do this, your job is to trouble the waters, mm-hmm. right? Like that's your job. So now when I walk into the space, it's like, all right, how are we troubling the waters, right? Everything we see is not how it is. So now, how are we now willing to engage that, go deeper with it, trouble it, and have folks think about what are we doing in the troubling, mm. right? But again, being very straight up about that, right? Mm. Not saying like, look, I don't want to look at this developmentally, right? We're going to go into the moment where we talk about race, white supremacy, like, white supremacy, race, first day. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you're not clear about that, this might not be the space for you. It's cool. No love loss. No acrimony. You know, no. Right, like, right. I'm not hating, but I want you to know what it is. And I think when we do that, that allows us to kind of open up our teaching, like you all do. When you say, "Look, I want to be present. I want to open up what we do." And now think about it and what it means in a classroom space, right? What many people fear doing. And when we look at when we ask our students about what happened in class and what they liked, oftentimes they say, it's like, look, man, you were clear about what this thing is. Yeah. Like it was no question about what it is that you were trying to do and you stayed with that, right? So that thing around really, I think that's a lesson we can learn from y'all in terms of being very clear up front and then being present and going through.
Yeah. So I got a question for both of y'all. Trouble the waters, right? Mm-hmm. As a principle of the scholar in these times. Like in my mind, Stove, you are an exception to the rule, right? That's mm-hmm. not, I don't think a lot of our colleagues would necessarily either say that or you know, have earned that mm-hmm. right to say that, right? So that's something that's not the norm, right? People don't trouble the waters as a first primary, you know, objective of their scholarship. So can we speak to the other part of our profession? Mm-hmm. And then for you, Calvin, like, I'm curious to know how much you see yourself as an exception to the rule within, you know, within the world of comedy. Like, is it the case that, you know, you said, no, I don't censor. I talk about whatever I feel I need to talk about. How universal is that amongst, I guess, for both of y'all, really, mm-hmm. as comics?
Yeah, I think the thing for me in terms of you get hired in academia and there are these conventions, right? So academics are supposed to look a certain way, sound a certain way, and then even occupy particular racial and gendered bodies, right? So when folks come into classrooms, they're expecting some old white dude, patchwork, patch on the sleeves, you know, the whole joint, right?
I feel like it's be a picture of that person, right? You describing.
Right behind us, right?
It's like three of them in here.
Right, it's three of them in here, right? You know, that is your prototypical professor dude, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the expectation. That's the expectation of the profession, right? And I was always, even as a young person, I was looking for people who were willing to trouble that, because when I came to college, I was like, what the fuck is this shit? Like, what is happening? Quick story. One of my first college classes was in an auditorium. It was 1,500 students. Ooh. I went to sleep. Nobody woke me up in Folinger.
Oh, that's a big ass, that's a theater.
Nobody.
That's in Illinois. Right.
Nobody woke me up. I woke up, fucking professor was talking about entomology. I was like, damn, what is shit? Econ? What the fuck? Like, I'm like, what is happening, right? So I was looking for the folks who was like, look, man, hell with this, man. What you trying to do, right? Mm-hmm. And that was, and I often would equate it to who was willing to talk about things differently, right? Like, mm-hmm. what you trying to do, right? What is it that you trying to get situated? Who are you trying to work with? How are you trying to work with them, right? And that to me goes against the convention,
right? Absolutely.
Of the university, right? But the thing is, if we know that we're behind that enemy line, then how do we find the people who are also co-conspirators around disrupting that, right? And be very explicit about finding, right? So now we have these conventions that we reject. We have to have our own conventions around who are the people that we're looking for? How do they talk? What do they sound like? What are they willing to do? How are they willing to step out against that convention? How have they shown up for you, right? So I think when you talk about it in, when you think about it in that way, you're no longer concerned with those conventions, right? You instantaneously reject them. And then you say, all right, look, if this is what the university has, you know, I can get fired any day. When I first got hired, I was like, man, this is like the longest 6-year postdoctoral research program in the world, right? Because in that year 6, they're like, man, it's going to be time to walk. Right? And I'm like, all right, word, right? I had it in my head that if it doesn't work out, I'm not going to be assigned to this place, right? But at the same time, being clear about who are also disruptors, right? So we don't do this work, and that's another false trope about the academy, right? That if you do justice-centered work, you do it as this kind of lone maverick. That's bullshit.
Right.
The thing is, you do this in community with folks. Mm-hmm. So now how do you locate that community? How do you ignite and animate that community to do the work that you're trying to do? But to do that from day one, not to wait until the crisis moment happens,
right,
but to do it when you get in that space. But that was the approach that I was thinking about when I thought about disrupting those conventions.
So I would just give, I'm sorry, real quick. I would just give just a little bit of pushback on that is that when he started off with the question is that he even said, you're an exception. So the rule is people not being disruptors. Like, y'all, we all old enough, not the production crew, that they're not going to understand this. But you remember Friday Chris Tucker was like, man, let's jump him. And didn't nobody do nothing?
Right. Man, sit your ass down. Sit your ass down. Right.
But when Craig stole off on him, now the whole hood out, everybody ready to go.
Right.
You know, he gets evicted, he gets sent off to jail. Now everybody got a whole lot of heart, you know what I mean? But it took somebody to step out. It took an exception to do that, and it's not always going to happen. It's the majority of the time, it's going to be just people toting the line or whatever, man. That's what it is through life. And then the exceptions, the disruptors, are going to have to. We see it in our world. How many people are just up there joking? How many successful people are just up there joking and going to do what they hold? I don't want to blow my spot because I'm desperately, I got bills to pay. But, like, there's more comedians than not are just up there just talking out the left side of the ass. And then it takes, you come to a Kevin Hart, like, he blew up when he told the whole world on Netflix that his pop used to get in with do some extra credit stuff because he was on coke. And now he's telling his truth. He's being a disruptor. He's being honest, the exception to the rule.
I mean, yes and no, because Kevin Hart doesn't push the boundaries of
not
comedy
anymore.
No, but I mean, everything he talks, Kevin Hart don't talk about politics.
Mm-hmm.
He barely talk about things that's going on in the world. Everything about Kevin Hart is very insular. I talk about my family, talk about my kids, I talk about being a celebrity and my friends and stuff like that. But he's not going to get on stage and say the things Dave Chappelle. Now, Dave Chappelle is the ultimate disruptor where he goes up there and he says, I'm going to turn the mirror around on every single group, and I'm going to make it very thoughtful and funny at the same time. And I feel like he gets more, like, ain't nobody protesting no Kevin Hart show.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
But that's the thing. We respect him for being that disruptor. We're talking about disruptors. If he was to come here to this campus tonight, there'd be a protest on it. There'd be people that walked out to school.
Who, if Kevin Hart came?
No, Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle. Right. No. But and the thing about the thing I love about Dave Chappelle is that Dave Chappelle, he to the point of like you saying, being a tenured professor and a comedian, Dave Chappelle has no ties to anybody. He don't have no corporate ties. He don't have no whatever. If Dave Chappelle says tomorrow, I don't want to do comedy, nobody's gonna be like, you have a contract to uphold. No, because he's free of any.
He lives on a farm in Ohio.
Yeah. So and I think, but that's because that comes from him being canceled at one point in time, and somebody being able to take everything away from you. And I think that's the the carrot in front of the horse, where it's just like, I can take this carrot away from you. And I'm not sure if, y'all being tenured professors. So my question was, when you were talking, was when to me, as a, I don't know academics. Mm-hmm. So when you come in, there's course material, mm-hmm. a book. Or is this is the course material you put that together? This mm-hmm. is my mm-hmm. course. This mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. so your personal like mm-hmm. thoughts and energy mm-hmm. is like absolutely. Reflected mm-hmm. in that. Okay, I get that.
Now you can be in situations where you kind of teach those larger classes,
an existing course,
mm-hmm. and they'll come with a format. Now here's where the mind fuck works. People use those things as guideposts, but you don't have to, mm-hmm. right? There's no requirement that you have to use that thing, right? You can use it for a guidepost, and when people are starting out, it's good to have those guideposts, right? Because they're kind of
giving you here's the curriculum, here's how
you set it up. But your job is really to say, all right, let me use some stuff from here, and let me see what works. Mm-hmm. And then in my reflection, saying, okay, I want to go a different direction. And the thing around, it's not so much of being the exception, right? I think really to your point, Mike, around the world tells us and rewards us to do certain things a certain way, right? So now we have to say, that's not it, right? Because what people would always say to me, you know, they're not going to listen to you. That's why I really appreciate young folks, right? They're like, they're not going to listen to you until you put on a suit. Mm-hmm. Fuck do you mean? What? What are we talking about, right? Yeah. And that was the thing, right? They're just not going to respect you. That's not what I came here for, right? Mm-hmm.
You was Allen Iverson. You came in.
Man, look, AI was looking, and it was so funny because we came in around the
room. If Spike Lee made a movie called The Professor.
but that thing around what you all are talking about, you don't have to do that thing. I trust, and this is my mom's wisdom. I trust if you do the things that you say you are going to do, and you try to do them with all that you can in the way that you can, the people you need will show up. Mm. Now, the thing is, do you see them when they show up? Right? And that's always the thing around, you know, teaching, research, or what have you. Like, what are you doing this for? Mm. Right? Like, you all have made a very explicit decision as comedians to be like, look, when I'm out here, we gonna do the thing. Right? And I try to approach every class in the same way. Right, and I have to go and shout to my partner, Irene, because she catches all of this at the crib. Right, so I come back to the crib, or sometimes when the nights don't go right, I come back to the crib, and I'm like, man, that shit was fucked up, damn. And she's just like, what? And I'm always like, yo, man, I didn't do this, I didn't do this, I didn't do this. She's like, okay, well, what do you do to self-correct? Mm, right, mm-hmm. What do you do now that this thing has happened? Right, and I think it's a different way of doing. Like, students don't expect the prof to come in and say, man, look, I'm sorry about 2 days ago. That shit was whack as hell. Mm-hmm. Right? But I have to do that, right?
But they can appreciate that.
Right. They'll say, yeah. Like, man, look, man, all right, cool. Like, we don't know why it was whack, but hey, we're going to go with that. Yeah. But I think that thing around really being clear about that. But I saw, it doesn't come from me as much as I saw folk do that. Right? Like, man, yeah. I had a professor. Her name was Tracy Orr. Shout to her. And she came in class one day with a bag of condoms. Mm. And she just started throwing it at people. And she was like, y'all don't use this shit anyway. She just literally started throwing it. She was like, look. And then she asked class, why did I do that? Right? And everybody was like, because you're nuts. And she was like, no. I did it because they are saying that we should not be doing this here. Mm. And if we don't have the conversations about what is actually happening to folks, then that thing that we're supposed to be preventing is going to continue to happen.
Yeah.
Right. It was just that clear. Mm-hmm. Right. And I was like, I'm in class, like getting hit with a condom. Like, oh.
Yeah.
I want to jump in and give you some additional flower stove, because there's a thing that you say. So to our listeners and viewers, if you're seeing Dr. Stovall for the first time, you can feel his authenticity, his passion, and the troubling the waters, right? That sticks. But there's an additional element to your approach, from my view. And I've seen this with students, with colleagues, whether you're in the community or in a conference. You bring a certain kind of humility and openness to engage. So you're troubling the waters, but you're doing it with good intent. And that's something that you said too, Calvin, around like, if I'm going to be honest, but if it's coming from a good place, mm-hmm. I'm not trying to offend. If it happens to offend, well, that's your problem to manage, right? And so that's an additional element. I would even say Kevin Hart has that, and maybe that's part of his success, right? He can name, he might not be political, but at least from a comedy observer, he seems to have he's going to be honest about his life. And part of his honesty is he's not political. Right. I've actually heard him talk about that. He's like, I respect the Chappelle or you know, the Richard Pryor or what have you, but that's not my brand of comedy, and I'm okay with that. And there's a truth to that too. Would you agree with that?
No, 100%. And I think whether it's students or it's audience members, when somebody's being present,
right,
they being honest and they're open to critique or criticism, I feel like that connects you more to people.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I say something on stage and somebody will be like, "That's not true," and I'll be like, "Well, I'll hear you out," and not in a way like a condescending way, or like, no, okay, if I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong, and I'll hear you out. And I do it all the time on stage, but I feel like that allows them to be like, oh shit, okay, because I mean, again, everything that I say on stage is my opinion and or beliefs, like in the moment, and if I'm wrong, that can change.
So you show up on stage as Calvin, not as a character,
right? And people can tell if you're at a comedy show and somebody's up there. It's like somebody pressed play on a tape recorder, and they start talking, and the timing is, and you just like you don't even see somebody back there getting choked in the back of the club because you just like it's right. Like
Chucky, and the crowd knows it,
right? So, yeah, but when naturally. if I go up there, hey, what's going on? Hey, man, I like that. You know, if I'm engaging with people now, people let me sit up. And I think that's the thing. Like you said, if you come into a classroom and you're talking to students in a way where it's just like, hey, look. This is what it is, and even the openness, like it's certain things you have to stand on as professors. This is what I stand on. This is my, you know, my business. But if there's something you have a problem with, we can have a conversation about it, and it could possibly change me. But also, I could dismantle that idea that you may have. I mean, you know, students are young and they haven't had as much life experience. But but being open to like have a conversation with them is always to me more connective tissue.
Yeah.
Then it just be like, no, that's just what it is. You don't know what you're talking about.
And they respect that. They respect that, right? Like when young folks feel as if they are being heard and listened to, they start to respond to you differently.
Oh yeah.
Right. And it's and that's a relationship, right? And that's a thing that takes some time to cultivate. I know here at this place. Zafir, y'all got to do that hella quick. Y'all got them 10-week quarters. That shit is wild to me. But that thing around really being honest about hearing folks. And like you said, if they see you adjust to that exchange that you had, then they're saying, okay, this person is also understanding themselves as a learner. I think the thing in the professoriate that we miss, we make the mistake that we stop becoming the learner. Right. And I think the thing is, we are always learning. And I think comedians, y'all do that better than most folks. Right. What am I learning from? And now can I put this to folks based on what I'm learning and seeing and doing?
It's the difference between creating and presenting. Right. I wanted to ask you a question. But first, I want to say, like, when it comes down to like the troubled waters, they have like the laws of power, or whatever, say stir up waters to catch fish. Nobody gives a shit about a perfect lake with no waves in it, right? The first thing you want to do is like cannonball into it, you know? Yeah. Like nobody's going to complain when things are going good. Like I haven't dropped a cell phone call since 1998, bro. I have never once called up my cell phone company and said, this is fantastic. I don't know how you guys are doing it, but keep it up. This is perfect. But right. If my Google takes more than 28 seconds to load, I'm going to throw my phone out the window. I'm going to cuss out whatever cell phone company and be like, you guys are trash. It's garbage. Mm-hmm. What the hell's happened? But nobody cares when things are going right. There's nothing you can quantify about the bank that didn't get robbed. Mm-hmm. It's just not getting robbed. But as soon as it gets robbed, somebody's got to do something about this crime. Mm-hmm. The mayor of Chicago is an asshole.
And that, I mean, that's another conversation about, like, even just living in Chicago, where it's just like that idea of something is always wrong in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, when you turn on news, I travel, I do comedy, internationally. Oh, Chicago.
Yeah.
And in my mind, like, how the fuck do you know what's going on in Chicago? I don't know what's going on in Houston. I don't know what's going on in New York. I don't know news nowhere else. But when I travel, people are like, man, Chicago,
as soon as you say that, people feel 30% less safe.
Man,
they touch their wallet.
What? You're from where?
It's just what? Chicago. I said, how do you know what's going on? But I mean, just the idea of like how and what's the reason for constant the troubled waters in Chicago?
That's,
like,
a good, that's actually a good segue and a point, because on that, I mean, I've seen a lot of Chicago comics use that stereotype as material.
Yeah. I use it to get out of fights all the time. You want what? Shot town, baby.
Right.
You want none of this?
But well, that's the thing, right? You get that. And it's all these spaces where you can go to, right? You can go to teaching in that. You can go to the history of that, because it actually goes back to, ironically, this thing we never say that. That actually goes back to white people in Chicago, right? We don't talk about that. Like, that's that old.
That's the original gang.
That's that old mob history. And before, you know, people started talking about Capone or what have you, it was Italian, German, and Irish folk here who were fighting, right? That's how you get that particular, I mean, Richard M. Daley, the first one, he was in a set, right? Called the Hamburgs, right? So this thing around really putting that into context, right? And now, like you say, when you drop race on it, now it just elevates, right? I go to places and you say, yeah, you know, I'm from Chicago. And then they go, have you gotten shot? Right? Yeah. You know, all of that madness, right? And you're saying to yourself, look, my city comes from operates in a particular context. Now, that context deeply impacts how people move. But no, when you're talking about it, you're talking about something that's happening in a context. And if we're not clear about that context, we can make assumptions that are deeply dangerous.
Right, of course.
And that thing around really being clear about that and really talking about, like, how do you get this particular space? And I always think about it as a good segue into a conversation, right? So, like, what's happening in Chicago? Disinvestment, gentrification, wrongful land appropriation, displacement, neoliberalism, right? So you
I don't want to hear that. I just want to hear that black people dangerous. That's say it's dangerous on the south side, and I'd be like, I know. You know what I'm saying? But like, but to all those points, it's like all this shit is cause and effect,
right?
Of course,
all this shit is cause and effect, and a lot of this, most of it, 99% of this shit is by design.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's like the idea that like, oh, it's just bad. And you just say Southside, and you say Inglewood. Mm-hmm. Like I tell people I bought a house. Oh, congratulations! I bought a house in Inglewood. Oh, okay, good. No, it's still good.
That's a good first step.
You know what I'm saying? But it's just I'm not afraid of black people.
Right.
I think that's the first thing is that, you know what I'm saying? I'm not afraid of black people, and I'm not, and nobody's invincible to anything happening to them anytime. Shit happens downtown Chicago. I grew up in Logan Square. Like, shit happens in, you know what I'm saying? But it's like, but the idea is just like, oh, if you're on the south side of Chicago and you're in a particular neighborhood, I'm like, shit happens everywhere at all times if you're in the wrong place at the right time.
Of course.
Right. So I feel like when you take that out of it, now people always say, oh, I'm from Chicago. Oh, man, I said, white people still live there. It's not that bad. White people, if they get up, if they start packing their shit up and leave, I might consider leaving. But let's stop, because I always ask. I'm like, do you say the same thing when a white person say, I'm from Chicago? No, you just imagine they live in some north
Cubs
suburb
games.
And everything is okay, good. But it's just like,
about why Kevin McAllister house,
right? Why do I have why am I placed in this dangerous situation? You know what I'm saying? So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That same thing. So I was ironically at Harvard. Mm-hmm. Go to a little coffee shop, white woman at the counter, and she's like, man, I like conversation about my tattoos or what have you. And I was like, where you from? And she was like, oh, I'm from Chicago. Now, there's another thing about Chicago. When you meet people in other parts of the world and they say they're from Chicago, we get very parochial around that, right? So don't say you grew up in Glen Ellen and say you're from Chicago. That's disrespect, right? Mm-hmm. But she said, so the next thing I asked her, where in Chicago? Right? And she was like, Western and Division. I'm like, oh.
Humble Park.
I'm like, you're from HP? She was like, yeah, you know, girl. And she was a younger woman. You know, as I get older, I can't gauge age anymore.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, somebody 20 years younger than me, I'm like, damn, are they 16, 17? Like, my whole gaze is off. She's like, yeah, you know, I grew up Western and Division, blah, blah, blah. We started chopping it up. And I was like, huh, this is the first time, and I had to tell. I was like, man, you're the first person in, you're a one of the first original Chicago whites that I've actually had a conversation with.
But isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
When she said Chicago, you started off with a list of judgments. Yep. Then she got down to Humble Park, and then you just transferred it over to another list of judgments. Because that's what Chicago does. Like, hey, what neighborhood are you in so I can judge you properly before I get to know you?
Right. But that's how segregated Chicago is.
Exactly. Yeah.
As a city.
Exactly.
Like, you say you grew up on the north side, south side, west side. That puts you into a category of like types of people, and then
you'd be like, oh, I'm from the south side. Oh yeah, where? Bridgeport. Oh,
because it's so segregated. It's crazy. We all from one place, but we all have different experiences living in those places. Like, I tell people I'm from Logan Square, they'd be like, oh, you grew up in a good neighborhood. I'm like, no, Logan Square has been gentrified now.
Trust.
But growing up in the 90s, like late 80s, 90s, it was just a different world. Like, I can't say I grew up in like it was like fucked up and dangerous, because my parents from the west side, but my mother moved us there because crack, all that shit was going on the west side. So let me kind of move you adjacent to that happening. Mm-hmm. But I feel like a lot of times when you say you from a certain neighborhood, it's like, to understand any city that you go to, wherever you from, you grew up in a neighborhood, there was an understanding, there was ebbs and flow in that neighborhood, and you just existed in that space. Nobody just riding down the street shooting guns, and it was like people just getting beat up for existing. Yeah, those things happen, but also it was an understanding of how do I maneuver around this, and do I want to be involved in those things?
Yeah. Mm.
So some things you can't choose, and some things you have to manage.
And I'm sorry, real quick. Now that we got the intros out of the way, we can go ahead and get to the. Could you get to the question that you had your first question? Because I think it was
like question number four. But we're on Chicago. We're on race. Let's talk. I mean, I think to our listeners out there, you know, we have a Chicago-based professor, Chicago-based comic. We have a new mayor in Chicago, Brandon Johnson. What's he doing? Is he doing good? Is he doing bad? Like, what's the assessment?
I mean, he got dealt a heavy hand. You know, just real. Now there's some mistakes, I think, that come out. But you know, first year you're trying to get your footing, and he got pressed. He got pressed in a particular way. And me and Calvin were talking about it before we started taping. And, you know, politics in Chicago are particularly unique because they come from a machine system, right? So in Chicago politics, it used to be like, look, if you didn't do whatever the machine said, somebody was coming to your house with a City of Chicago jacket on, and it might not be good for you.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's how they used to move in the city. So now that machine has been broken up and parceled a little more, right? So you don't see those older remnants. You see some older remnants of the machine, especially when you look at administrations, because there's a group of people who stay employed in administrations that they keep. So Brandon, you know, man, I know the dude, right? So, you know, I know him from his teaching days and his organizing days, right? So he left the classroom and then became an organizer for the union that he worked for.
He taught in Chicago Public
Schools. In CPS, right? On the west side, right? So this thing around... Really, so there's the expectation of doing certain things, right? Once you get into office, because you've made these campaign promises, then you come into office.
And he platformed on a progressive
on a progressive agenda, right? So, but when you come into office, and you first thing you see is that budget, and it ain't nothing what folks have told you about. The second thing, you got all these people in your ear, and you got to have great discernment around who to listen to and what to do. And you got to be clear about what it is that you come to stand on. Now, this is good, back to our earlier conversation. I think, and this is just me, I think a mayor who is safest is someone who is willing to say, here's what I can do. I will stand on the things I am trying to do. If you need to go another direction, I have to be at peace with your choice. But while I'm here, this is what we're going to do. Right. And that's a different type. That's a different type of understanding. You move differently when you have those types of spaces. Now, I haven't seen that from him yet. Right. Because he got hit with some stuff. Right. He got hit with a migrant crisis that he inherited. He got hit with a budgetary collapse. He got hit with COVID money that's disappearing. Right. And he tried to put forward a progressive tax that would address housing. Right, that the community of corporate landlords teamed up against him and engaged in some illegal practices to get folks not to vote for it. Yeah. Right. So you gotta inherit those losses. But I think the most important thing, and I'm not seeing that as much as I would hope, is him to stand on the things that he's trying to do and not be shifted by the will of the DNC or the Democratic National Convention or the people who are in his ear saying that you need to pander to these folks to be successful. I think this is a moment to really that he can really pull from Harold Washington, right, who never got a chance to live out those spaces because he died in office.
Did he die or was he killed?
Hey, and it's a real situation. As Chicagoans, we always going to ask that question. And the thing with Brandon, and I think there's still the promise of doing, but he has to, this is the moment after year one, you got to make that shift. You got to say, here's what I'm trying to do, and here's how we're going to move. If I don't make it past this 4 years, that's what it is. But let us not be moved by what folks are saying, but let's keep our pulse on what people need.
I think you're absolutely right. He got hit with a lot, but I got hit with a pothole on Western coming out of my apartment.
Trust.
What are you doing? What are you doing for the city? Like, don't we all feel like politics for the most part is just WWF? Like, you can't send a frog to go fight a scorpion. Like, you're sending another scorpion. Right. We inherently believe that politicians are playing a dirty game, which they are, which means you got to get dirty. Even if he came in and he was really sunshine and rainbows and righteous and all that, he's going to do that for, what, 2 years?
Yeah.
Until he's made too many deals and he's got to think about re-election?
But see, and this is the conversation we had. I said, I think it's crazy for anybody to campaign for a job they didn't have and make promises that they don't know they can keep. That's like me being like, when I become night shift manager at Walmart, it's going to be free soda in all of vending machines.
Calvin, we're not allowed to give out free soda.
Well, it's going to be free soda in all the vending machines, and you can take something from the hot bar when you go on break. It's like, and then you get that, they're like, you can't do that. And he like, but I promised all these, you know what I'm saying? It's like, you never had that job. Yeah. How can you tell me you're going to do something that you've never done before?
Yeah.
And like you said, you're going to walk in and be like, that's your desk, that pile of shit on there, take care of that.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, just get
the
to that.
The funny part is that the last night manager promised everybody free grilled cheese sandwiches. And when we didn't get grilled cheese sandwiches, we was like, man, he's full of shit. You think this next guy's really going to give us free sodas, though?
I believe. And the thing is okay, so you got to deal with that shit. But then on top of that, you black. So as inherently, black people like, you got to be for us. Obama, we voted for Obama. Obama do something for black people. And Obama like, yo, I'm in charge of the country. And I promised all these people that gave me millions of dollars what I would do for them. And you just black.
Yeah.
you're black and you don't have any. I'm sorry. Yeah. You don't have any money. I can't. I'm a see what I can do. But the community gave me a lot of money over here. So I gotta, you know what I'm saying?
But this is, and there's a historical point to this, right? So I'm old enough and for our production team, check out a cat named Michael Belandic. Michael Belandic was the mayor in the 70s. He lost an election because he couldn't get the snow trucks out. Literally. People were like, nah, dude ain't fucking with the snow trucks. Homie. No, we gone.
Right?
Like, you gotta go. Like, and in Chicago, like you said, you got a foot of snow and no trucks. What are we doing? Right? And he thought he could do some cost cutting when it was like, nah, homie, you got to go.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's how Chicago gets Jane Byrne.
Just practical.
Practical, right? So I think if you start to think about those practical, because what if somebody just came through with a progressive progressive agenda that said, all right, y'all, look, shit. Look, think about a press conference. Somebody just comes in and says, shit, look, it's pretty fucked up right now.
Yeah.
Now, here's what we can do in the fucked upness, right? I don't want to promise you anything slick, but here's what we can do right now, day one, first 100 days, and we just going to do it, right? I'm not going, as soon as I hit the gate, I'm going to just go with that thing. They're going to tell me to do other stuff, and I'm going to say, go with the thing that we did, and then let y'all figure it out.
Right. How much of a lie do you want, though? What? Like, I want my doctor to be honest, unless it's bad. Then I want you to be optimistic. Nah, be optimistic. Lie to me, bro.
Hey, listen, you're going to be able
to. I want my airplane pilot to be honest.
You're going
to
be able to hug your family.
Optimistic.
You're going to be able to hug your family.
All right.
But you better hug them fast, because you're not going to. You see what I'm saying?
I
feel like that's when you talk about politics, and to the point of, like, all this shit is make-believe. if like you're saying, you being honest, hey, they gave me $2 million for my campaign, I got to look out. Yeah. I got to look out. But I understand y'all also voted for me. This is what I can do for y'all. Because I feel like when I'm watching that video of the lady going up there, oh, you said you supposed to be the HNIC. And she going off on Brandon Johnson. And I'm just like, lady, I think people just in life, people oftentimes, they're only concerned with how they feel about something. Mm. This is how I feel about it right now. And but they never take into consideration, what is Brandon Johnson dealing with? Mm-hmm. I understand you have a job to do, but I also understand that there was a mayor before you, like you said, left a pile of shit that you got to clean up. So it's like, is it even realistic for me to sit here and be like, you're not. And it's just like,
we have the politics in our game though too, right? Like you book somebody and there's kind of an unsaid, unspoken, like if they have a project or they have a club or they have a room, they're going to book you. It's the comedy credit. Like it's the favor game. And with politics, that's a whole lot of power. We're trying to get followers, money, spots, a special or whatever. But politics is like power for real.
But this is the thing. It kind of goes back to an earlier question. You all know the conventions of comedy, right? And there are people who will operate in it politically, right? To kind of make power moves or what have you. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who will open doors and keep them open for the folks who have committed, right? So there's this thing around like, so, you know, I know he's a polarizing figure, but I always appreciate this about Cat Williams. Mm-hmm. Cat Williams has a policy. When he goes to a city because of his experiences as a homeless person, as a person who was houseless, who was housing insecure, he makes sure he cuts off a chunk of that dough that goes to any services for unhoused people in those cities.
Wow, right? I didn't know that.
Like he just does that, right? Just off top because of his experience, right? Doesn't need fanfare about it, doesn't talk about it a lot. And he says, look, I need to be clear around where I come from and how I open that gate, right? So somebody who's in that convention, and you all have demonstrated that, when you all open that gate, right? So beyond the favor, you're like, man, I know this young blood. You know, y'all two talking. You're like, man, I know this young blood. He nice, man. Let's give him a spot. Let's give him 10, 15 minutes at a spot. Let him do his thing, right? Those types of things, I think, are different from people who are trying to make the power play, but who are saying like, no, let's open the door. So our job's affair is to say, if we open that door, keep it open, support the folk, and keep in tune with them. Right. And I ask for nothing in return. Right. Because I think those things, again, this is, again, my mother's grandmother's wisdom. Those blessings that you are able to have folks access to come back. Right. And they come back tenfold. Right. In ways that we may not even see.
Right.
Right. I think it's important to really think about that. So, you know, you got those folks in the political game, like me and Calvin was talking about one of my homies who's in that space. You know, we be texting each other, and she's just like, yo, the fucked upness is at a new level, right? But that thing around, but she's always, I know all the time, if I hit her, she's always going to be like, okay, look, what you trying to do? What do you need? Let me see if I can make that happen for the folks, because we're in that space with each other that we know that we ask for nothing in return. And we know if we can put folks in those spaces to do the things that they're supposed to be doing, we're going to do it.
Let me come back real quick to Chicago, right? And it's 2024. The convention's happening. How does the Mayor Johnson's current policies, you guys were both, you know, it's a lot of hard stuff going on. He's doing his best. There's a lot of different commitments. How does it play into, like, is Trump, like, Trump was just in the Bronx, right? Is he coming to Chicago next? How does Chicago play into the elections coming up on a national stage? Right. And does Brandon Johnson's administration get made as an example of like, look, here's a left, you know, progressive black mayor who, and look at Chicago, look at these migrants, look at houses. Is that the story that's gonna happen?
Can I actually ask you, how are most of the major cities in America like Democratic by default? New York, L.A., Chicago. How do you think that happens?
How do I think that happened? I mean, I think you have, I don't know. That's probably a a longer convo, but I think there's a lot of college-educated folks, and I think college education folks lean towards Democratic Party. And I feel like there's a thing around big cities. Big cities, you get exposed to different kinds of people. I think there's an intrinsic way in which that makes you more acceptable liberal. And tolerant. I don't know, you can call it liberal. I think tolerant. You know, I feel like being around different kinds of people, you know, you're going to have a more open point of view.
And it's a strategy game, too. So the Democratic National Convention has a strategy of having more people vote. Republican National Convention has a strategy of fewer people voting and making it harder for people to vote. Right. So if you got more people, that's going to be more akin to cities. Right. So now you have more people voting, whereas the Republican National Convention always does this thing. Right. The GOP always says, you know, we have this problem with illegal voting. Right. That has never been an issue. Right. But it's a narrative that they want to play to restrict voting. Right. That's always been a strategy. So this thing around looking at one group of folks who want to say, let's have the most people who can vote, then another group of folks saying, let's make it harder to vote. So that thing around, they play that numbers calculus with each other in terms of what they do.
I didn't mean to disrupt your question.
No, I'm just curious to know what we think about this year. I mean, how does Chicago play into the national politics? We got the DNC coming. Trump is, some people say, likely to get reelected. How does that play into Chicago politics in the current moment?
I honestly don't know anything about politics that well, in terms of even like the convention. I don't know anything about politics. I just hope traffic not fucked up when you
right.
How long is it gonna be?
Right.
I need to be gone.
Right. And that's how a lot of Chicago's like, look, what days? Okay, let me move around. But the other part of this is, right, they've quelled protest. They've created this kind of no protest zone. Right. So if folks are talking about issues in Gaza, folks talking about health care, housing insecurity, they don't want them anywhere near the United Center where the convention is taking place. So now Johnson has to get into a space to say, all right, welcome to Chicago, but I want to be clear around what it is that you're in. Right. Now, that's a bold move. Right. That if you came to the DNC and said, welcome to Chicago, I want you to really understand that the majority of you folks are supported by folks who believe that folks who look like me shouldn't be here. Right. And because they shouldn't be here, now you move in particular ways and you create these false narratives. Right. When you go that hard in that space, then it changes it up. Right. But that's quote unquote risk political futures. But if you're just trying to tell the truth, it's different.
So how do you think he's going to play it?
I think he's going to do the welcome to Chicago thing and, you know, all the things, global. hot dogs, Bears games, global city. But the thing is, it's like, all right, we've created this no protest zone. Right outside the no protest zone are people who are actually talking about the survival of folks, not only in this city, but across the world. And now you got to think about, what are those folks doing and who will you side with, right? So now this thing around playing this political calculus now has to be called in front of us, right? What are you willing to do? Because now you have said the people who have voices can't even be in proximity to you because you're fearful of what they would do, even though you have no evidence. You actually have more evidence to the right that actually is more harmful, right?
But isn't that what keeps it going? Like they say in show business, all publicity is good publicity.
It's a WWF thing.
The same thing that happened for Trump is the same thing that happened to Barack Obama. Barack Obama, if nobody paid attention to him, if they didn't try and clown him for being black, if they didn't start making fun of his name, if they didn't keep his name in the news cycle,
he wouldn't have been Obama.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And they was making fun of that on Fox News. So guess what? Now you have him in my brain. You know what I mean? The same with Trump. At first, it was they could not get enough of clowning him and keeping him in the news front. So if there is a protest, now you have something else to talk about. It's still backfiring. It's like the oldest like trick in the book. You see it nonstop. So the more you protest him, the more you keep his name floating out there. Right. Mike Pence, when was the last time you even thought about this dude? Never. Nobody covers him. How many votes is he going to get? Seven?
I think this thing, there's this moment, right, where you have to understand, and I think, Safed, this is where all four of us, this is where our job really becomes important, How do we start to get folks to look beyond that lens that's put in front of them? Right? How do we get folks to get beyond what the 24-hour news cycle is telling them? Right? How do we get folks to say, look, there's something else here. And if you go for the WWF of this thing, it could be all bad. Right? And that and that thing around really being, and not all bad in terms of some kind of conjecture, some stuff that you're creating, but just all bad in terms of what it is that they're saying, right? Like this campaign, the Republican National Convention has this thing. Is it, I can't think if it's called Election 2024 or Project, it's like Project 2025, something. I mean, when you read it, it's nuts. Right? You're just like, oh, shit. Right. I mean, they're talking about straight up repression, right? They're talking about military occupations. They're talking about martial law. I mean, and how to do it, right? Not as some kind of panic stricken thing, but saying, all right, we got somebody crazy enough to try to make it happen. So now here's where we have to think about how are we preparing folks to think about this and to see it differently.
Right. It reminds me of a line from Patrice O'Neill that I keep close to me is have an opinion, but don't let your opinion have you, which a lot of people just go on a stance. Like I'll watch a video on YouTube and I'll go to the comment section before I even think to make my own opinion. I'll see who's got the most likes. Yeah, that's what I would have thought. And then now that's how I feel about it, you know?
Yeah.
But I was going to ask, you had on one of the questions, and I think we have some experts in the house. Could you tell me more about DEI? Like I've heard of it. And I think I have a book definition, but I don't know what the practical, actual, what is that?
Talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, is that an institution? Is that a job? Is that a title? Is that a feeling?
That's a whole apparatus. But I think, you know, let's start with the question. I want to put it back to Dr. Stovall because he's an expert in this area of work. A related issue, critical race theory, right? That's one again. It's an academic term that's somehow shifted into the public discourse, playing into politics. Could you, for our listeners, Dr. Stovall, what is critical race theory and why should we care about it?
Yeah, I think when we talk about critical race theory, one of the people that you have to talk about is Derrick Bell, right? Derrick Bell had this, he was looking at the ways in which housing discrimination, employment discrimination, and discrimination in terms of segregation was impacting people. And he started to look at documents in the Constitution. He started to look at federal housing regulation. And then he had a group of students who actually were taking his classes. They all come up in 1989, they come up to Madison and they have a conference about his work and then what people were doing in relationship to his work. And then the term critical race theory appears, right? So people talk about CRT and they only talk like it doesn't have like the progenitor, like, I came up with this, blah, 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 blah. So it was actually a collective definition that was based on a lot of work that Derrick Bell was doing, largely that came out of a book called Race, Racism, and American Law. And what he was arguing was that racism in the United States is endemic, meaning that it is foundational to its creation, right? And that thing around, and we can see how racism is foundational to the creation of the United States, in things like the 13th Amendment, the preamble of the Constitution that says that Africans will only count as 3/5 of people. 13th Amendment says enslavement ends except if you're not in jail, right? 14th Amendment, due process with folks do not have access to. And then 15th Amendment, the right to vote, which is always contested. So he looks at that and some of his students, one who was Kimberly Crenshaw, says, and a very famous law professor says, that we are not just impacted by racism/white supremacy, but we're also impacted by gender, age, ability, sexual orientation, gender expression. And she actually found court cases where the courts would say, you have to choose one. And her response was, I should never have to choose one if my body is experiencing all these things at the same time.
And that's where intersectionality as an idea first, I think, really became.
And that was the argument of intersectionality, right? So there were folks like Gene Stefanczyk, Richard Delgado, who wrote primers for critical race theory. Then there were people who took it in education, like one of our OGs, Gloria Lassen-Billings, mm-hmm. Danny Solorzano. And they were starting to say, look, we have to do a couple of things. If we recognize how racism and white supremacy, racism slash white supremacy, I don't want to delineate the two, operate in all of these spaces in human life, what is the active work we are doing to change it? So there's a praxis element, right? So less time with abstract theorizing, more time on the ground working with people who are struggling to be not just included, but to end how white supremacy affects their lives, right? Mm-hmm. And when I say white supremacy, I think it's important to say, right? White supremacy, when I mention it, I'm talking about the assumed views, values of white, Western European descended, able-bodied, cisgender, heterosexual, Christian males as normal, right, and good. And that becomes the convention that everyone else is judged upon, mm-hmm. right? And if we do not engage in that convention, then we are othered. We are isolated. We're marginalized, right? So that is what critical race theory is, not what Moms for Liberty or Christopher Rufo or all these people who are opposing it. But it's really around saying we are naming something that has gone unspoken but lived and known
right.
by everybody in the United States. It's just to what extent are we willing to articulate
so
how
if I can highlight one thing, yeah. right? So one thing I'm hearing you say is it really – critical race theory is like an advanced legal theory,
mm-hmm.
which means all the claims and all the fuss around is it in our schools is kind of ridiculous, right? People are starting this in law school.
Mm.
Having said that, are there traces of crit or critical race theory that are in schools right now, and should it be?
Right. Well, let me, and for the record, and I think it's important. Thank you all for having this format. Did I teach CRT to high schoolers? Absolutely. Right,
thank
absolutely.
You.
Did I teach CRT? Did I teach things like the racial contract and the ways in which white supremacy operates, the nine areas of human life and activity, the code for understanding concepts of white supremacy? Yes, right? I taught all of that to high schoolers, right? And I taught it to high schoolers because they are living in a world where something is happening to them, and CRT allows a mechanism by which to articulate it. Right.
Name it.
Right. To name it. So that was the point. Right. So this thing around people, CRT becomes the boogeyman, because what people are doing from a critical perspective in schools are saying there are things that impact your life as a young person. You should be asking questions of it and working with others to change the condition. Mm-hmm. Right. So that thing around how do you locate that? And if you locate that, here's the work. Now, CRT is one of the pieces that contributes to that. And it's not this all thing, all white people must die type shit, right? That's always the when you say something that racism, white supremacy, and they're like, this person is anti-white. Nuh-uh. We got to actually start with what this country was founded on, right? Enslavement, genocide, wrongful land appropriation, according to the people who wrote the damn document.
Is it something that can actually change? Like, I hear it in mm-hmm. the concept on paper, I believe, mm-hmm. but the concept put in practice with human beings that have biology and chemicals and bad days mm-hmm. and breakups with their girlfriend. So, like, quick, one of the most major lessons I learned, probably the only thing I picked up out of my 5 years and two summers in high school was, and I grew up military family. I lived a lot of countries in a military family. Mm-hmm. So I grew up and went to school in Okinawa, Japan, mainland Japan, England, handful of states, right? I'm in mainland Japan, and on a military base that I was on, every possible race you could think of and combination thereof, these are all military guys. They're flying around the world. They're picking up wives from different places, having all kinds of kids. So I'm in my social studies class, and we had assigned seating, right? And the teacher said, hey, tomorrow we're not going to have assigned seating. Just sit wherever you want, right? And he had the desk organized however our class was. The next day we came in, he had the desk set up in a grid, you know, rank and file, right? And he was like, hey, guys, remember, just sit wherever you want to sit, right? So everybody just sat naturally next to your peer group, the people you kick it with and talk to the most. Mm-hmm. So we started class. He said, all right, everybody stop and turn around. What do you see, right? Pretty obvious. All the black kids over here, mm-hmm. all the white kids over here, the three Japanese exchange students over there, all the Filipino kids back there, everybody else mm-hmm. fit in where they fit in. no prompts. There was no racism involved. Mm. There was no, I don't like them. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, whatever. We just sat to the people that we naturally, this is my clique. This is my mm-hmm. group. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know what lesson I did learn other than you look at Chicago. You got Ukrainian Village, mm-hmm. you got the South Side, West Side, you got any, you know, Boys Town, whatever. People naturally do this, right? And then if you're going to be in a group of people, you're going to want to have a voice. You're going to want to have a sense of power. You're not going to want to be marginalized. And then that's just kind of how it feels like life goes by. So when we identify it, is this identifying it to say, okay, hey, look, the boogeyman has a name now, mm-hmm. so now we can see him when he walks into the room, or is there actually a way to fix what I think is human nature?
Well, I want to mm-hmm. cut you off. I just want to jump in. I think the issue isn't that people find like minds and people. Right. The issue becomes you can't have this and you can't have that, and we're going to be on top. I think that's the problem with critical race theory is that you're trying to teach people is that, hey, we can all have the same shit. Yeah. We can use the same water fountain. We can all have property. We can all own shit.
That's called communism, is it? Didn't they talk about that in George Orwell, Animal Farm? They fought against the farmer, freed the farm, and then all the pigs said, hey, everybody, we're all equal, but the pig's just a little bit more equal. We're going to live in a house.
See, and that's the thing, right? So actually, a student asked me, he said, well, look, isn't that communism? No. Here's the thing. I think when we start to talk about, when you talk about your classroom in Okinawa, we go to places where we feel we're safe.
Right.
Right? And when we go to places that we feel that we're safe, and to Calvin's point, now you have a system that drops on that and says, I'm going to prioritize certain people who look a certain way, who come from a particular place. Mm. And now I'm going to regulate what all these other people can do, right? I'm glad you mentioned Filipino students, right? There's a scholar out in California named Funi Su who studies colonization in the Philippines. She came to UIC and showed us these pictures, man. I was like, whoa. So, you know, we started hearing about Abu Ghraib, all the stuff that was happening in the Iraqi conflict. When they started talking about waterboarding, she showed a picture from the early 20th century that used to be called the Filipino solution, and it was waterboarding, right? So this thing around how do we now make these distinctions on groups and move against them in particular ways and regulate them? Because it's no problem if we sit with the homies that we kick it with, the problem is when we start to prioritize who gets what in that classroom and starts to sit everybody, whoever's in that back place, okay, we're not even going to teach them. We're just going to go with the folks who we prioritize, right? Because the world says they should be prioritized. I think the recognition of that now says, well, what can we do differently?
Right. It's like Black Wall Street, where it's just like, oh, we got our own shit. Y'all do y'all thing. We thriving over here. And they like, no. Yeah. We got to fuck all that up.
Break that
but
up.
But I also feel like, I mean, when you say critical race theory, I always say, like, everything is branding. Right? Because we got to get rid of affirmative action. Affirmative action ain't shit but corrective action.
Yeah.
Right? Because really, if you called it a corrective action and you say, X, this is the reason we're doing this, to correct some shit that was wrong before.
Yeah.
Oh, that affirmative action sound like some shit a robot would do, like affirmative action. Like we have to carry out. But right. So when you say we're going to teach critical race theory to children, people are going to be like, oh my God, this sounds like a fucking 400 level cop. Like just call the shit the truth.
Right.
We're going to teach the truth.
Yeah.
And now it's like, oh, okay. You see what I'm saying? Whether you accept it or not. I think, and I learned in improv, going to Second City and shit, it's like information is just that. The feelings you put behind that information is what dictates how people receive the information. Mm. Hey, man, I got to tell you something. The cat died. And you might, as soon as somebody say it in a way that makes you feel like, what happened? The cat, man, fuck that cat. But if I came to you and be like, hey, man, the cat died. Now you decide what you do with that information. And I feel like the problem is when I don't watch the news much, but when you watch certain things, how people give information to people, it makes them take the information in like that. And I think we got to take that part away. I'm not trying to fight you. These are the facts. And then we can have a conversation after that and how you feel about that. But the facts are the facts.
And I think that's the main thing around CRT, right? To say, look, we're not talking about any conjecture here, right? We're talking about the ways in which people have moved. Like, this OG sat me down once, and he was talking to a group of us, and he said, man, look. He said, I want y'all to look up the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. He was like, what? And he was like, we were all looking like, what? And he said, yeah, I had the exact same reaction. But he said, I want you to read how Benjamin Franklin talks about indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
Man, there's a section in this book where Franklin talks about intentionally poisoning them. Right? I mean, he talks about how they did it and why they did it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, damn. That ain't never, we always thinking about the dude with the kite and waiting for lightning.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Well, here's a dude who's talking about explicitly poisoning people, right? In order to make way for U.S. expansion, right?
So, and they have his picture on the wall up there right now.
Yeah, exactly, right? You know, I mean, you're just like, man, I mean, like.
Cancel.
And think about how many Benjamin Franklin schools, how many Benjamin Franklin societies we got, right? But we cut that out, right? We cut out Sally Henning and Thomas Jefferson, right? Mm. Seven babies. Mm. That man had seven babies with her, right? And that ain't even in the conversation. Damn, what are we doing? Mm. Right? So this thing around how do we now start to bring that into the fold and say exactly what Calvin said, how do we create a filter by which to ask a question, right? And why is asking a question so much dangerous? Right? Why is that so dangerous? And I think that's the piece, right? When historical accuracy becomes the threat, that's when we're in trouble, right? Because if it's not, then you say, all right, let's deal with what it is that we're trying to do, right? Here's the thing.
It boils down to go all the way back to the beginning of the conversation, Calvin, your story around if you're going on stage and someone before you trips and falls and you don't say anything about it, that's a problem, right? At the end of the day, I think the whole thing with critical race theory, as you described it, it's about just being honest and goes back to the question of the truth. And so these are, yeah, they're different terms and they're branding, but I feel like the work of, you know, what's going on right now with all the campus protests, what's going on with critical race theory and DEI, there's some people in the academy that are just like, we have to just be honest. People are showing up in this university paying a lot of money. A lot of people are going into debt to come here. I feel like the least I can do is to make my best effort to be honest. And critical race theory was just an effort to create a language, a framework to say, let's talk about these things. Otherwise, we're leaving people to just make sense out of it on their own. And that's kind of what it boils down to at the end of the day for me, this piece around honesty and naming the realities that are around us.
Well, the good news is that this conversation just solved all the world's problems. So I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in for it. This has been a dope conversation. I truly appreciate you. I'm going to speak on behalf of Sapere and myself for this one. Truly appreciate you gentlemen for being a part of the first episode of PCWB. Any parting words before we get out of there?
Man, when we doing part two? Just this open like dialogue, like just from like I obviously like I'm finding like
I got like
jokes.
Full credit just from listening to him.
He said
I was
credit.
Gonna ask him like where'd you get all these college words from, and I was like duh.
He said you got two college credits.
Yeah. I'm about the home economics pass.
Man, but no, this is a great space, man. And man, yeah. I hope y'all continue this on for many, many more. And I love to come back.
It's dope, man. Make sure you guys check out, do your Googles on Calvin Evans. He's not hard to find, and he's going to be in a city near you, wherever you're watching this at.
Indeed. And just that, you know, when you all have made a conscious effort, this is evidence of a conscious effort to shift how we think and move, right? And I think that's a really important point in a day and an age where people say that you should not be doing this. And I think this is the revolutionary work that we need to be engaging all the time when we're in a situation like the orange man cometh, right? So I think it's really important.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you to all of our viewers and listeners for tuning into the first episode of PCWB, a professor and a comedian walk into a bar. I think we made our point. I think we proved the concept. This is an engaging way to think across different art forms, from comedy to academia. Tune in for the next show. If you found what we did today interesting and engaging, we appreciate your support.
And everybody had on clean gym shoes, but mine's the cleanest.
Right? Appreciate y'all. See you on the next one.
It's ready to go. This is the Red Bull, bro.